Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator tonight. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. This evening, we discuss reconstructing healthcare, the pros, cons, benefits, and pitfalls of universal coverage. The healthcare situation in California and all over this nation is nearing a breaking point, with costs skyrocketing and fewer people covered by a comprehensive plan. Those who do have coverage often find themselves paying steep deductibles, copays, and other fees. Those without coverage often forego healthcare or burden the emergency room system, where they know they will not be denied care. When employers elect not to offer coverage, the burden falls to local, state, and national governments, and there is concern our public entities are not equipped to deal with such a massive financial responsibility. Tonight, we take a closer look at the state of California's varied plans to address this issue, while also looking at what has been happening on the national front. We hope to discuss the issues of fair access, cost, and quality of care. We're very fortunate tonight to have a distinguished panel, and let's start with Dr. Arnold Relman, who is Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School and former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. E. Richard Brown is Director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. Anthony Wright is Executive Director of Health Access California. And John Kavatek is Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Let me start by asking each of the panelists a question. I'm going to begin with Dr. Arnold Relman, who is author of a fairly recent book called A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare. Dr. Relman, you write, as you noted as we were talking before the program, from a physician's perspective, which is rather unusual in the healthcare debate. What is the physician's perspective of this mess?
It's non-existent. Doctors are not a single voice. They do not speak with one mind, and it's good that they don't. I can tell you what this physician's perspective is. It's outlined in my book, but my perspective is that the healthcare system is near destruction now. It cannot continue much longer the way it is. That's because, as you've already noted, costs are exorbitantly high, and they're rising at a rate that is simply not sustainable. If you think that's hyperbole, go to the newspapers now and see what's happening in Detroit and what's happening to General Motors. General Motors is on the verge of bankruptcy. They're fighting to stay alive. They're facing a strike that started because of their rising health care costs and their inability to meet them. So, from my perspective, the major problem is that we can't afford to spend all the money, and we're not getting our money's worth. The system that we have is not taking good care of us. Many of us are uninsured. 47+ million are uninsured. Many more are underinsured. The quality of the care that we're getting is highly variable. The best medical care in this country is the best in the world. But also, some of it is the worst. It's unequal, it's unfair, it's inefficient, and wasteful. So, aside from that, it's fine. It's got to change, and it will change, inevitably. The question is, how is it going to be done? Who's going to be responsible for making the change? And what kind of a system will we be able to develop in the future?
Thank you. Richard Brown, you are director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. You have also written extensively on the problem of access for the disadvantaged to health care. And you've also been involved in formulating a number of policies to address the situation. What really can be done to address the problem of access for the disadvantaged when the fundamental problem is either they don't have jobs or they can't afford health care?
Well, as Dr. Relman noted, we have multiple problems in our system. We have 47 million uninsured people. We have more than 16 million who are underinsured, which means that they're at high risk of medical debt and personal bankruptcy if they have one serious encounter with the medical care system. And we have costs that are out of control. So these are all problems that our system faces and that we face. The only way to gain control over our costs is to first bring everybody into the system. Currently, we have a voluntary system. Employers get to decide if they're going to offer coverage. Workers get to decide if they're going to accept coverage if they're eligible. And everybody else gets to decide whether they're going to participate. You can't run a healthcare system that consumes one out of $7 in our total economy in that very lackadaisical way. We also have a completely fragmented payment system. Every payer goes out and negotiates their own deal, shifting costs to everybody else that they can. So what we really need to do is have a system of universal coverage, and we need to bring our financing system into some kind of order so that everybody has to be participating and contributing. And when payers are paying doctors and hospitals and for pharmaceuticals, they're paying in a consistent way that doesn't start shifting costs between the different parties.
John Kabatek, you are Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. I'm interested to hear from you the perspective of this from businesses. I mean, businesses sometimes get blamed, especially those that are either not offering health insurance or offering inadequate health insurance. But tell us from a business perspective, this is not a system right now that's working for business, is it?
No, and John, thanks very much for having me. And representing NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, we represent about 22,000 small and independent businesses throughout the state of California. And for the past 20 years, healthcare has been the number one concern for small business. We recognize individuals, business, government cannot afford healthcare, and small business wants to be sure everyone has access to healthcare. However, we don't believe government-imposed mandates or taxes are the right prescription. Forcing small business owners, and we all know one or have been friends or been one, to spend money they don't have is not the answer and will have severe effects. It's important to point out that our members aren't big business. We're not Wall Street. We're Main Street with smaller operations and smaller budgets. Less than 50% of small businesses in California can afford health care compared to nearly 99% of the larger businesses that can. And yet small business makes up the majority of the economic and jobs base. When unexpected costs go up, small business owners will have no choice but to either hike prices, which drives away customers, or make cuts, such as leaving positions open, laying people off, or closing their doors. A recent study by NFIB found that the new mandated 7.5% payroll tax in California in the first 5 years would cost California business, mostly small business, nearly a quarter million jobs and $67 billion in sales. We hope that the special session that the governor has convened and the legislature has convened will address the issue of affordability. Small business owners tell me that they believe incentives and flexibility versus mandates, government mandates, are the key to ensuring that all Californians have access to affordable health care. And what are some realistic approaches small business believes, or just that? We believe in transparency. We think that actually empowers all California consumers with information about real costs that give them greater control of their health care. And we believe Californians should have greater access to neighborhood clinics, community clinics, such as in grocery stores and malls, to bring greater affordable health care closer to the consumer. We think our members believe that small business people believe that individuals who purchase health care should be allowed to deduct those premiums from their personal income tax. And we should also make it easier for employers and employees to contribute to health savings accounts, where the employer and the employee together contribute towards health services and products and a fund for that. Finally, making it more portable, making healthcare more portable. We shouldn't lock people into jobs because their insurance can't travel with them. People should be able to take that to their next job. So NFIB and small business believe we should be able to access quality and affordable health care. But as we're developing these approaches, it's important that we remember to do it within a competitive framework where no large bureaucracy is telling us what to do.
Anthony Wright is Executive Director of the Executive Director of Health Access California. You've been involved in lobbying and working on these policy issues for some time. You've been before the Chronicle's editorial board talking about these issues. You certainly have spent a lot of time up in Sacramento with the legislature. I have to observe in the opening minutes here, we talked about how we have a system that doesn't work for doctors, that isn't working for patients, that we've got 47 million uninsured people. We've heard where businesses are feeling the weight of this. What are the political impediments to getting something done? If that isn't a critical mass, what does it take to get something done in Sacramento?
leave the easy one to me, huh? Thank you. I think healthcare is one of those unique issues where because there's so many different interests in play. I mean, you have the doctors, you have the hospitals, you have employers, you have insurers, you have patients, you have that. So it's not like some other issues where you have, you know, the environment and polluters and there's a spectrum in between, or and not to say that the environment is an easy issue by any stretch of the imagination, but this is an issue where you have lots of different intersecting issues. And so even if you can figure out an issue, an agreement between one set of competing forces, say consumers and insurers, then you still have the whole labor employer access or the insurer provider access or, you know, one of the other issues of division. I think also, frankly, you know, it's sort of like trying to thread a needle, but trying to thread three or four needles at the same time, because you have to get through both the issue of policy, what works in terms of what you can finance, what works with regard to federal law, you know, what doesn't have some perverse incentives, but also how to deal with the political maze of the different interest groups, but also the public. I think the public at one level has had an ambivalent relationship with healthcare reform. At one level, they do see that there's all sorts of issues and all sorts of problems. At the other level, they're very protective of the coverage they have now. So I think that's an issue. I think one of the exciting things, and one of the things that's just very striking, is that you also have very different philosophies, and there's nowhere where the philosophies are more striking than just looking at Washington, D.C., the headlines from Washington, D.C. today and the headlines from Sacramento, where you have a President Bush threatening to veto a state child health insurance program that would expand health coverage to 4 million more children, to veto that proposal that it was done in a bipartisan way. And if no resolution is done there, we may actually see literally hundreds of thousands of California children be disenrolled from the health coverage they have now. And in the conversation we're going in California, where we're actually trying to expand not only children's coverage, but public programs, employer-based coverage, set new rules on insurers so people are not denied for pre-existing conditions, all the issues that are on the table in Sacramento, although still not resolved. So it is a very stark contrast, even just the conversations that we're having in the two capitals that we'll talk about this evening.
Thank you. A reminder that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we are discussing reconstructing healthcare, the pros, cons, benefits, and pitfalls of universal coverage. I'd like to pose this question to Dr. Relman, certainly being from Harvard Medical School, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm interested in looking at healthcare from a national perspective, because there are continuing attempts right now as we speak in Sacramento to do something about healthcare reform. We've seen efforts in San Francisco and other cities to at least do some, you know, patchwork and filling in some of the gaps in healthcare. But the question I have is it really possible to address healthcare other than to really address this issue, if not from a national perspective? Because one of the things we hear time and again when something is proposed at the state and local level is it really doesn't work because it would either the cost of health care would put the state at a competitive disadvantage or that people would move when they got serious illnesses to areas that had universal coverage if others did not. Dr. Rillman, what do you think the prospects are for getting something done at a federal level?
At the federal level, that's the only way we can solve the problem. States cannot do the problem. States have to have a balanced budget by law. They do not get most of the tax revenues from their residents. Most of the tax revenues from their residents go to the federal government. And it is impossible for a state by itself with its own resources to solve the health care problem. A state can be a testing ground for a plan, but I do not see it as being able to solve the problem completely for itself. It must be a national problem. And I want to make it clear that the central problem is not that we're not covering everybody. The central problem is that it's so ridiculously expensive and we're not getting our money's worth. An enormous amount of money wasted, taken away by business overhead and profit and administrative costs and fraud. And we have to have a unified system, everybody contributing what they can in a fair and equitable way, employers, employees, individuals, and the federal government, all contributing in an appropriate way into a single unified fund which will provide fair, comprehensive coverage for everybody. And all of this business of shifting costs from one to another, I can't afford it, he'll have to pay for it, that won't work. The only countries that have good, decent health care systems that are affordable are countries that have national plans and a commitment to a national insurance system. There may be some private contribution, but not very much. Let me make one more point. The United States is the only country in the world that acts under the delusion that health care is a business, that it's a market. It's not a market. It's a social service, and it's a social responsibility. And I don't believe in socialized medicine. I want to make that clear. I believe in a private delivery system that is mandated and supported by fair, relevant government regulation. And everybody has to contribute what they can, and it has to be all together, but not run like a business. In my book, I give you evidence. Business takes out of the healthcare system probably a minimum of 30% of the total amount of money we spend on healthcare, maybe as much as 40. And when I say take out, I mean not for delivering healthcare, but for its own overhead, administrative expenses, management expenses, and profit, and fraud, and whatnot. So there's an enormous amount of waste in the system. And the rising cost of health care, I'll subside in one more second. The rising cost of health care, which is the killer, the rising cost of health care is because the health care system in the United States is being more and more regarded by the providers and by the insurers, by the private insurers and by the private providers and by the doctors, God bless them, being regarded as a business. And when you run a business, you have to generate more and more income. You have to grow your business. And if you're an investor-owned business, you got to keep the stockholders happy by making more and more money. Last year, the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company, this is their SEC filings, I'm not making that up, made a profit of 40% on sales. Now, just think about that, what that does to the cost of pharmaceuticals, and in general, what profit and administrative costs do to the cost of health care. We have to change the system from top to bottom
Dr.
in order
Rillman?
To solve the problem.
I apologize for cutting you off, but I'll make it up by telling those in our radio audience who didn't have the benefit of seeing the book title as you were waving it that your new book is A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare. Thank you very much. I want to give some of the other panelists a chance to weigh in on this question of national solutions. Richard Brown, we were talking before the program about some of the presidential candidates have come up with their proposals. Hillary Clinton, most recently, she and Senator John Edwards are arguing over whose is more original. Do you see a proposal out there among the presidential candidates that one would work and two would have a plausible chance of passage?
I do. I think that actually the three front-running Democratic candidates, interestingly, all have issued proposals which are nearly identical to one another. Beyond the details, beyond the names they give to different components, what they all have in common is articulating a perspective of universal coverage. The one exception is Senator Obama, whose proposal doesn't require everybody to join in, and therefore can't really claim to be totally universal. But in other respects, all three of those candidates, Clinton, Obama, and Edwards, have very similar proposals. They favor, one, universality. Everybody must be in the system. All employers must be contributing at lesser rates than they're paying now, but they must be contributing either by providing benefits to their workers or by paying into a public fund, which would then help subsidize workers and other people's coverage. Secondly, they don't do away with private health insurance. For those of you who favor that, you may be disappointed, but they regulate it. They organize it. They require that it meet certain standards and that even cost increases need to go through a vetting process before insurers can do that, and they must meet certain minimum benefit standards and all kinds of arrangements like that. They can't turn people away. They can't jack up costs to individuals, et cetera. And then third, they all would create a new public program, a new public plan that would be modeled after Medicare. And one of the interesting components of that is that that public plan would then compete with private insurance plans on a level playing field. And by doing so, that becomes a test of whether a government-run system in a fair, organized system can actually compete against private insurers. Many of us think that it can and can do so very favorably. Others are skeptical. But it would become a national test of this kind of arrangement. So they all have that component. I think on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, the Republican candidates have really not come up with any serious proposals along these lines. They have made vague comments favoring tax credits in some cases, favoring doing nothing in some cases. And I think that this is an issue which is the number one domestic issue in the presidential race. All of the candidates are going to have to answer to the voters on this issue, and I think they ought to be prepared and be prepared to lead if they are the ones who get elected.
John Kabatek, let me put this question to you in terms of whether you see the need for a federal solution, adding a point that one of our audience members made in their question card, saying that the National Federation of Independent Businesses was one of the key players against the Clinton health plan in 1993. Right. What do you think? Can this be solved at the federal level?
You know, John, I think that this is something that we all, that's a dialogue and a solution that we all need to work together towards. I think this is state, federal, and at the local level. I think one of the things that we applaud is the fact that you know, the governor, the legislature here in California are getting the issues out on the table, allowing people to come to the table to talk about the issues, talk about solutions. So I believe it actually needs to be a shared decision in terms of getting people together to find the right solutions, talk about what the root is, talk about affordability, talk about how people can afford health care. And I think that's something that, again, really needs to be a crux of the discussion at every level. As people are going through this, and how can small businesses, how can employees, how can government, how can everybody afford health care? But I think the issue of affordability is something that needs to be more discussed.
Anthony Wright, did you want to weigh in on the issue of whether this needs to be a federal solution?
Yeah, I obviously we would all prefer a national health system, a national solution. But you know, today is a big baseball night in San Francisco, so let me quote Yogi Berra: "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." And right now, the fork at the federal level is pretty closed. If we're having a debate about how many children we're going to disenroll in California under the state child health insurance program. So given that that fork is closed, there is a real opportunity at the state level to make progress, to move forward, even if the end goal is a federal solution. In terms of what has been on the table in California, it's I think that the big debate that Rick Brown mentioned was between the Democratic and the Republican candidates is a fundamental one, which is about, are we going to solve this as a group, where we come together to share the risk and cost of healthcare in groups, or are we going to place the burden on the individual and basically give people health savings accounts or other things and just have the burden be centered on the individual? It is my, as a consumer advocate, I strongly favor group coverage because it is where, as a group, we can get the best bang for our buck in terms of purchasing power, where we can share the risk and cost of healthcare. Because, you know, even though I pay into my healthcare system right now and I don't use much healthcare, I know one of these days, by age or accident, I'm going to need a lot of help with my medical bills, and I want to be part of a group to help share that risk. What has been on in the over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had in Sacramento several bills that actually would expand group coverage. There was a bill in 2003 to expand coverage to require large employers to provide health coverage to their workers so that that people had at least the benefit of employer-based coverage. In 2005, there was a bill to expand coverage to all children in statewide public programs. And in 2006, there was a universal single-payer health care bill sponsored by Senator Sheila Kuehl that would put all Californians in a single pool to get their health care. All three of those proposals were blocked by Governor Schwarzenegger, either by vote, by the veto, or by on the ballot. But the good thing about this year is that instead of saying no, 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 he put, at the beginning of this year, he said, this is what I would say yes to, and he put a proposal on the table. It wasn't a proposal that I would embrace all of. There were some good elements, there were some bad elements. But the point is, it started the conversation in Sacramento, and that's why there's opportunity, and it would be remiss if we neglected the opportunity in Sacramento when there's real people who need health coverage now, and we can't wait for Washington.
Let's get to some audience questions. We have a number of terrific questions that are pouring in. Let me start with this one. Do any of you panelists think that the health care system is improved, underline improved, by the participation of private insurance companies? Is it worth the monumental bureaucracy and overhead that the participation entails? Anybody thinks it is? Dr. Relman?
Well, you'd be surprised to know that I think the private, for-profit health insurance companies are damaging the American health care system, are causing higher costs, and producing fewer benefits than we otherwise would get. If you examine very carefully what the private health insurance companies do, you find very little evidence that they add anything to the health care system that is anywhere near worth what they're costing us. This issue has been studied very carefully by health economists and other people. The overhead costs of private, for-profit insurance companies ranges anywhere from a minimum of 15% to a maximum of 25 or 30%. That's exclusive of the additional overhead costs that they cause the providers, the hospitals, and the doctors to spend in order to deal with them and billing and collecting and all their rules and regulations. Now, the private for-profit insurance industry in this country is a huge industry, hundreds of billions of dollars. And if you take 20% or 30% of that, you've got enough money to pay for the costs of all the people who don't have health insurance now. It is a scandal. I'm so old that I remember very clearly when the private insurance companies went into the healthcare business. They were not selling health insurance when I was a young doctor, when I started out. They were selling health and life and fire and everything else, but not health insurance. They went into it because they saw the opportunities for great profit. And as long as we allow the private insurance companies to continue to dominate the scene by their power, their lobbying power, and their wealth, we are going to pay a terrible price. No system, I lay this out as a flat challenge to any of my fellow panelists, no system that has to go through a private insurance system is going to control costs.
Well, let me, the question actually was whether any of you think the health care system is improved by the participation of private insurance companies. Dr. Rillman obviously took it as a rhetorical question, but do any of you do any of you literally think that that private insurance does have a role in health care?
Well,
Richard Brown?
I'm going to answer it in a little different way. In the absence of universal public health insurance, yes, there the private insurance industry has something to offer, which is why it started. It started at Baylor College in Texas when Blue Cross was first formed to offer health insurance coverage to teachers. And what they were able to do was organize an insurance market, spread risk, manage the costs, and offer decent coverage to people. The problems really began to occur, as Dr. Rellman pointed out, not when insurance companies, all of them, came into the picture, but when for-profit commercial insurance companies entered the picture. Because what they did was undercut Blue Cross, and they would go to employers and they would say, hey, you're paying an average cost for everybody in the community. That's really shared risk. But we can offer you a deal where we'll cover your young workforce that doesn't cost much, and we'll charge you less for that. As they did that, they began to capture more and more share of the marketplace and force the nonprofits, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, to follow that pattern as well. Today, they're indistinguishable in the way they fundamentally do business. So I think that in the absence of universal public insurance, private insurance can organize these markets, can share risk. But I don't think they offer anything of value if we are thinking about them as an alternative to public insurance. I think public insurance has been demonstrated throughout the world to offer a better deal, not only to the people covered, but to society, to business, and to taxpayers as well, and doing it by providing variable quality of care, just as we have here, but in many countries like France, uniformly very good care.
Let me go to a couple of questions that have been customized for individual panelists here. This one for John Kabatek, who of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. John, there's been talk of, in your opening presentation, of greater transparency for healthcare consumers. In other words, more information about healthcare prices. The audience member says, I'm not going to stop, and notes that if she's not going to stop and do a price check if she breaks a leg or has a serious illness. Does transparency really make a difference?
Yeah, I really believe it does. I believe that it has, there's very similar analogies to when all of us go out and look for cars, we look for computers, we look for clothing, we do cost checks. I think it's comparisons to find out exactly what is going to be the most affordable. And really, I think the more information, and I think technology, John, plays a really key role here. I think the more that people have the ability in this technological age to find information, they're going to make better decisions. I think we believe, you know, and I think most small business people, I think most all Californians really believe that when people are able to choose in a free market what works best for them, they're going to make responsible decisions that work and responsible decisions that last.
May I?
Please. Dr. Rellman, go ahead and jump in, and then we've got one for Ann.
That's the wisdom of the business community, but when they make sense, they're talking about smart purchasing of insurance, not smart purchasing of health care when you need it, when you're sick. Now, I don't believe that anybody in their right mind, when they're brought into an emergency room having been run over by a truck, or when they've had a heart attack, or they've been diagnosed with a brain tumor and have to have a brain operation, shop around the way they would shop around for buying a car or a consumer or a refrigerator. You're dependent on honest, competent medical advice. We have to have a medical system that we can trust, that's not incentivized by bad payment systems to do more than is necessary or to do less than is necessary. We have to have a healthcare system that works for us. You can't shop for medical care when you're sick.
Anthony Wright, I know you wanted to jump in, and then we'll go to John Kabatek. Anthony Wright is Executive Director of Health Access California.
And I am often on the other side of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, but I'll actually agree with you on this point, at one level. I absolutely agree with Dr. Relman on the fact that consumers, the notion of health savings accounts, the notion of quote-unquote consumer-driven health care, high-deductible plans where people are being asked to make cost and quality decisions that it's hard for CalPERS to make, and you're asking the average consumer to do it, I think is ridiculous. However, what I would agree with you is that transparency is important, we in this country and in this state do not get the price of something in terms of at a hospital or a doctor actually has very little relation to the actual quality of it. And we need transparency in our healthcare system to identify where is the high quality, low cost sector and who provides that, and who provides the low quality, high cost healthcare. But that information is for the group purchasers, and that's why the notion of group coverage, whether it is through public programs, whether it's through large employers, whether it's through a universal healthcare system, is so important, because they have the ability to look at that information, make judgments about it, make contracts with it. But you're not going to ask that. You know, when I'm talking about opposing individual burden on healthcare, I think we want to talk about it not only just from on a cost perspective, but on placing all these obligations that you have to go. This is the purpose of why you want to be in a group, so they can help you with that process, because healthcare is really complicated, and consumers need that help.
John Kabatek, you wanted to weigh in?
And Dr. Relman, I think the last four words of your commentary was very poignant, which is what works for us. And when we talk about us, we talk about individual decision-making, ability to make responsible decisions if we have the best information possible. And by allowing...
About the treatment of your brain tumor?
Well, and when you talk, I think one of the things is when Dr. Relman talks about people coming in to be treated, and if there's a broken leg, obviously doctors have a Hippocratic oath to treat people who are in need. We're talking about care that people have year-round. They should be able to, just like we are consumers for anything else, we should have the ability to shop and make responsible decisions. And small business owners who don't have a large profit margin, when they're forced to be mandated with a one-size-fits-all system, that's going to hurt a lot of people who want to do the right thing. So let the employers and the employees, number one, have flexibility to choose what works and give people more options and more affordable options to make the decisions. We're all big boys and girls. We can make good decisions together.
Okay, Richard Brown, you've been waiting patiently.
Let me give you a very quick comment on that. In response to John's comment, because the reality is that 80% of all of our healthcare costs are generated by 20% of the people in any given year. And if we are focusing on the 80% who are generating 20% of the costs, we're not going to control our healthcare spending or its growth. And those are the kinds of decisions that you were just describing, John. The everyday decisions, where should I go for my kid's acne treatment or whatever that situation might be. But the really expensive kinds of care that people have for serious chronic illnesses or for an accident or for some very serious acute condition, those are things that as Dr. Relman said, you want to go to your doctor, you want to get the best advice about where you can get the best care, and you're not going to go shopping around. I know we didn't when my wife had what's called an arteriovenous malformation, which is a life-threatening condition in the brain, and it suddenly appeared. We didn't want to go shopping around to find where we could get the cheapest deal in Los Angeles County. We wanted to find the best care. And we took our doctor's advice, and she got the best care. It happened to be at UCLA, which isn't the most expensive place either. So you don't shop around in those kinds of situations. And where you do shop around, those are the low-cost things that really aren't going to affect the upward trend in healthcare spending.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're discussing reconstructing healthcare, the pros, cons, benefits, and pitfalls of universal coverage. Our panelists tonight are Dr. Arnold Relman, who is Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Richard Brown, who is Director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access California, and John Kabatek, Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And I'm John Diaz, the moderator and the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's go to another audience question, and that is, everyone appears to agree here that a universal pool makes sense. So why not simply mandate that all individuals can obtain coverage without considering pre-existing conditions at the same cost and make the pool as wide as possible? Thoughts on that? Who wants to jump in?
Who's going to pay for it? I mean, that's a great idea, but who's going to pay for it? You have to have a system that makes sense and is fair and will meet the costs. And by the way, those of you who read the New York Times or can see it online, this past Sunday, February 23rd, there was a huge editorial, one of the biggest editorials I've ever seen the Times run, called The Battle Over Healthcare. And what they said was that the elephant in the living room that nobody seems to talk about is the cost issue. And none of the leading candidates, Republican or Democrat, offer a plan that is a realistic solution to the cost problem. If you had a good solution, a fair national solution for the cost problem, then you could afford to cover everybody. And as I've said, the waste in the system alone would cover the costs of the uninsured.
But I think, Dr. Relman,
this is Richard Brown from UCLA.
You can't really control the costs of our healthcare system until we cover everybody. And I think that, in addition, trying to gain control over the healthcare costs is politically far more difficult than it would be to adopt policies that would cover everybody. I think that's why it makes a lot of sense to first tackle the issue of universal coverage, get everybody in, begin to do something about the costs, get everybody in as contributors to the cost of health insurance and health care, and then you're in a position to begin to do something about the costs and tackle them.
Anthony Wright, the issue of individual
yes.
mandate has been an enormous issue in Sacramento and one of the real dividing lines. What is your take on that?
Well, we are all for a plan that includes individual responsibility. I mean, again, that where people have to pay into the system with regard to what they are able to pay. What we are not for is a mandate to go and buy coverage that, without regard to ability to pay, without any shared responsibility from an employer or from a public program or a government agency, without consumer protections with regard to rates, or even without the benefits of group purchasing, the benefits of being part of a group to get the best possible bargain. I mean, I think we are for individual responsibility. I mentioned a number of the things that the California legislature has passed, of which we've supported all of those proposals, because to the extent that they required individuals to pay either through taxes or through a contribution, it was within that framework. But the notion that we're just going to have a blanket mandate to require you to buy it without regard to your ability to pay based on a percentage of your income, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, the piece of Governor Schwarzenegger's plan that we have particular concerns with is a proposal to buy coverage where the where there would be no exemptions based on affordability, and where the minimum standard you'd have to buy is a $5,000 deductible plan. That's not coverage. That's not universality. That's just telling people to go buy a product. However, we would be supportive of a proposal like Senator Kuehl's proposal, or through other forms of group purchasing, where you have to be part of it, but you're in the game with a public entity, with an employer, with somebody else who's sharing the risk and the cost of health care.
John Kabatek, did you want to weigh in on
sure.
the individual mandate?
Well, sure. We believe, you know, and personal responsibility is a core value of small business people. And you know, in this case, though, you know, we believe that mandates, you know, mandates of any sort don't really address the main reason why small business do not provide coverage. And I know I sound like a broken record here, but again, coming back to affordability, I think before we even have the opportunity to speak about individual mandates of any sort, we need to talk about how people can afford this. And that's putting the cart ahead of the horse if we're not doing that.
Richard Brown, did you want to weigh in again? Or
I'll let it pass.
Okay,
thanks.
Great. Well, let's go to another question. And I think there's a very pointed question coming up, because we've talked a lot about, and we'll start with you, Dr. Roman. There's been a lot of talk about the profit motive and how that skews decisions, and the profit motive. And how that, especially with insurance, and works against patients. Here's a question. I have HIV, and the drugs that keep me alive every day may be the product of the profit motives built into our market system. Can this innovation exist in the public sector?
Of course. It's a myth that the innovativeness of the pharmaceutical industry requires huge profits. Most of the basic inventions, including the early anti-HIV drugs, are developed with federal money by laboratories, either at NIH or academic laboratories supported by NIH money. The pharmaceutical industry largely licenses ideas, licenses patents, from either small companies or institutions like the Harvard Medical School that invent the major new drugs. It's a myth that the pharmaceutical industry propagates that they have to have large profits. They are the most profitable industry in the country. They used to be, last year they were second to the investment banking and oil, which is pretty profitable. This year, they're the most profitable again. And I told you, Pfizer, the biggest pharmaceutical company in the world, has a profit margin this year of 40%. Now, if the public thinks that's a good idea, I think they don't understand the name of the game. So, of course, we have to have creativeness and inventiveness. Of course, we need scientific investigation. But it doesn't have to be done by the big for-profit companies. Most of it's being done at non-profit laboratories and in small startup companies.
Richard Brown, you've done some research as to how the healthcare systems work in other countries. Mm-hmm. Does that provide some guidance to this question?
I think it does. I think we can learn a lot by looking at other countries and the different ways in which they organize their healthcare systems. And they are all quite different from one another. We may think of them as single payer, or some of you may, but in fact, they are very many different models. One of the things that I think is quite clear is that for-profit insurance companies organizing the financing system has been a disaster for this country, and it does not exist in other countries in allowing them to organize the financing system. Where for-profit businesses in healthcare do play a role, and they do in all the industrialized countries. All the countries with national health insurance systems or national health services have for-profit health care. They have for-profit drug companies in their midst. They have supply companies. And in France, which has universal coverage, it has health care costs that are a third lower than those in the United States. They provide high-quality, responsive care to everybody in that society. There actually are more for-profit hospitals there as a proportion of all hospital beds than we have in this country. But government plays a strong role in organizing the system, in regulating it, in setting limits, and in requiring that everybody be participating in financing it, that there be an organized system of payment, and that people cannot game the system. That's the key, is making sure that government is there as our watchdog, overseeing the financing and the delivery system to protect us against the price gouging and the excessive profits that we see in so many medical care industries in this country.
Rich, do you think that Hospital Corporation of America or Tenet would be happy to operate under the French system?
No, because they would have their profits limited.
Exactly.
They cannot come in
That's
and simply... Well, and we agree with that. I agree with that, and that I said before that I think the for-profit health insurance really doesn't have a place in organizing the system. And it needs to be a minor player, if any player, in the insurance system, because that's the key to controlling our health care spending, ultimately.
Well, if we are going to talk about the profit motive here, I have to let the executive director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses weigh in. John Kabatek, your thoughts?
Well, if we're talking about, you know, basically the plan for single payer of, you know, and looking at other models, you know, the words that keep coming back to my mind are freedom of choice. Freedom of choice. You know, a single-payer plan, you know, really creates one large, one-size-fits-all. And I say one-size-fits-all because that's really what is the issue here of an HMO that's run by the state or run by the federal government. It eliminates competition. It eliminates the freedom of choice. And government, you know, and really has no history of running social welfare programs very well. Social Security is on the brink of bankruptcy. Medi-Cal is paying doctors below cost. It will lead to the rationing of care, poor quality, and tax increases. And if anybody thinks that that's not the case, why are there so many people coming to our country for care right now and escaping single-payer programs?
Richard Brown, I know you wanted to jump in, and then we'll go to Dr. Rellman. I think Anthony Wright wants to.
I'd like to come back.
We're going to give everybody a shot on this one.
I'd like to come back to the example of France here, because France is a universal system of insurance and a universal system of care. It is rated in comparable public opinion polls that are administered across these different countries, including the U.S., France, England, Italy, Canada, a number of countries. It's rated as having the most responsive health care system in the world. Talk about freedom of choice. Patients can go to any doctor they want. They don't have to get permission from an insurance company to go to a particular doctor. Doctors can order any test or procedure that they think is merited. They don't have to go and get permission from the insurance company. And in fact, when the patient has seen the doctor takes the patient's medical record card, which has got a microchip in it, and simply puts it into his or her microcard reader, has access through that to the patient's entire medical record for treatment purposes, and at the conclusion of that visit, submits a request for payment to the patient, who is responsible ultimately for the bill, but the insurance company pays that bill almost instantly through the electronic system. It is a system that works really well. Why is that so important? Because the government there has basically organized health insurers, and there are multiple health insurers in France. They're just very organized, highly regulated, and they're nonprofit, and I think that's the key.
Thank you. Anthony Wright of Health Access California, I know you...
There's a lot of talk when you talk about healthcare at the theory, and I just want to bring it down to the choices that people have now in our current healthcare system. There's over 6 million uninsured Californians who, as a result, live sicker, die younger, or one emergency away from financial ruin. People make choices every day in order to make sure that they have the health insurance that they have now. There's a term called job lock, where people stay in the job that they have even if they don't want to, maybe even stay in a marriage they want to, because of the health coverage. That's a stifling, and to make the business pitch, that's a stifling in terms of entrepreneurship. That's a stifling in terms of people trying to express themselves creatively. So, I mean, I actually think that creating a basic standard of health coverage actually creates the security that allows for freedom of choice and mobility. And I think that that is, I think, is crucial. I don't think we have to argue over the big, large theories when we have real restrictions of choice in our current system. There are proposals that are in the legislature right now that would improve on that security and improve, not solve everything, but get us closer. And that's what we need to look at.
Great. Dr. Relman?
I just would like to respond briefly to what John said about government-controlled health care. Medicare is, in essence, a single-payer system run by the government. You ask any group of patients, people over the age of 65.
But not doctors.
Pardon?
But not doctors.
Oh, doctors, too. I talk to doctors all the time. So they're complaining because their fees are being cut down, but they always get the fees raised back up again. People across the country consider Medicare to be a blessing. And it is most doctors, most of the time, think that Medicare is a great idea. It does not interfere with people's freedom to choose their doctor, with doctors' freedom to choose how they think patients ought to be treated. And it's, again, part of the myth of those who believe that anything run by the government can't be good. Would you like to have a private-run national park system or a Coast Guard system? Would you like to have a privately run Department of Defense? We almost have that now, as a matter of fact. I mean, there are certain things that the government does very well. The National Institutes of Health is a triumph, is a jewel, and no private business would do that because it's not profitable. But it's in the public interest. There has to be government input when the private sector cannot do it. Healthcare is one of those areas.
John Kabatek?
Great. Well, you know, as you're thinking about that concept, I think it's important to be sure that we keep in mind, you know, that let's ask the under a million Canadians who are on waiting lists to receive care. Or let's ask the 1 in 8 British patients who are waiting about a year or over a year for care. Let's ask people how government works for them. Oh, but wait, they're coming to the United States because that's how we work. In a good way, private, competitive, let's open it up to the free market.
A brief answer. Great Britain spends 50% as much on health care as we do. Canada spends 60% as much on health care as we do. I know Canada very well because I've made many visits there, been visiting Canadian hospitals, talking to Canadian doctors. I'm going there day after tomorrow. If the Canadians spent 80% as much on health care as we do, there'd be no waiting lists, and they'd have the best health care system in the world. It's simply a question of whether they are willing or able to put enough money into the resources that are necessary to deliver high-tech care when it's needed. When they do that in isolated places, in particular cities or provinces, there are no waiting lists. That's also a big myth. The Fraser Institute in Vancouver wants you to think that Canada is a terrible hellhole of inadequate health care. That's nonsense. The health care there is excellent, excellent. And I know because I've visited many Canadian hospitals. It's true. Some people don't want to wait to have their elective hip surgery done, so they come to the United States.
One of the advantages of having a panel of experts like this is we can get an audience question throwing out some figures that I have no idea if it's true or not, but I know we probably have one of the four here can answer this. And that is it true that 50% of all health care costs are for the first year of life and the last year of life? And what can we do about that?
No, that's not true. It's a myth.
Okay, then we'll go on to the next question.
The facts are that Medicare spends about 25% of its resources on health care in the last 6 months of life. Now, that doesn't mean that's futile health care. Most of that money is spent when the doctors and the patients think it's going to keep them alive and it's going to be good for them. Now, as a doctor, I tell you that most people get sick before they finally die, and they should be treated. They should be treated.
Speaking of
people...
The amount
of money that's wasted in needless care... famous case that was a big political football.
Let's get one more question on the issue of personal responsibility from an audience member. That being that people in general are not being held accountable for their own health dysfunction. They overeat, they overdrink, they smoke, drug abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And then they expect the medical community to fix them. Why not hold people accountable for their choices? Who'd like to take that one on? Anthony Wright, you're a brave man.
Yeah, I think we should do everything we can to encourage healthy behavior, healthy eating, healthy lifestyles. But we also that means that we have to give people the healthy choices to make those choices in the first place. If you're in a community that doesn't have a safe place to do the walk or the jog around the park, if you're in a place that doesn't have a farmer's market to get leafy greens, that's a lot harder. And the only, if you're in a community where the only food outlets is the Taco Bell and the fast food joint, or that's the only thing that may be affordable to you, that's a different situation. And so I do think that we need to encourage healthy behavior, and that is something that is being talked about in Sacramento and elsewhere, is trying to encourage that. I do have a problem with a penalty system because a lot of these conditions are genetic, are circumstantial.
Economic, social?
I rest my case.
Richard Brown, we are fast running out of
just,
time,
just
but
one
I'm
quick
going
obs-
to give you the last word.
One quick observation, that all of the major health care reform proposals in Sacramento include significant programs to address this very concern and to increase not only personal responsibility for health, but to provide assistance and alteration of the environment to support those kinds of responsible individual actions.
John Kabatek, I will give you the last word because it's certainly personal responsibility has been part of your message here tonight.
Sure. And we believe that, again, coming back to the fact that small business people want to do the right thing. They want to make sure that their employees and the families that they have affordable health care. And one of the points of that as it relates to prevention is an important one. I think that many of them, and we are excited about the opportunity for more of a dialogue and effort for more prevention opportunities. Let's educate people how to take better care of themselves. I think that way we avoid things. I know we have a governor who's very focused on physical fitness and very much so, and that part of that dialogue is very much an important one, which is let's make sure we avoid problems before they happen.
This has been a terrific discussion tonight, both energetic and substantive, and the audience participation has been off the charts. We could be going for probably another couple hours, but we are going to have to wrap up. And let me give my sincere thanks to the panelists for their participation here tonight. Dr. Arnold Relman, the Professor Emeritus of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. Richard Brown, Director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Health Access California. And John Kabatek, the Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. I also want to thank my audience here tonight at the Commonwealth Club, as well as that on the radio. Tonight's program, I remind you, was generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you, guys. You guys were terrific. Thank you very much.